Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Plastics, that was the one word of advice to Dustin Hoffman in the movie The Graduate. And it is hard to imagine our world without them and all the industrial chemicals that go into nearly everything we buy and own and into producing our food. Today, we're surrounded by plastics, pesticides, and industrial chemicals. They are in our blood, our bodies. The levels are low. The government sets strict safety standards. But some scientists are convinced that these standards aren't strict enough, that very common chemicals may be making us sick in much lower amounts than anyone previously thought possible. Tonight on Point, the body chemistry of America. New insights into the good, the bad, and the toxic in the environment and in your bloodstream. We begin tonight in Atlanta at the Centers for Disease Control, which last week released findings from the largest study of chemical exposure ever conducted on human beings, findings on the chemicals in America's blood. Thousands of blood samples were compared to samples of a decade earlier. Dr. James Perkle is Deputy Director of Science at the CDC's Environmental Health Lab. I asked him about the findings and whether scientists were heartened or frightened by the results.
Well, I think it's important to understand the study. This study was the most extensive assessment ever done of the exposure of the U.S. population to environmental chemicals. So it's very broad. It looked at 148 different chemicals in about 2,400 people in the years 2001 and 2, and there are lots of results. Some of the results are things that give us cause for feeling better about environmental exposure, and there are some other places where we need to pay more attention, and there's a bit more concern.
Give us the good news first, Jim. What do you see there?
Well, there are really two main highlights in the good news area. A substance we're always concerned about exposure to is lead among children, and we found that since the early 1990s, the percentage of children that have elevated blood lead levels have dropped from 4.4% to, in 2001-02, we found the level was now down to 1.6%. Now, we're still very concerned about children living in homes with lead-based paint, but overall, this is good news.
You're attributing this to that lead-based paint being cleaned up. Does it have to do with unleaded gasoline as well, or that's not the issue here?
Well, lead was out of gasoline by the early 1990s, so these really are having to do with lead poisoning prevention, largely lead-based paint, and somewhat lead being taken out of soldered food cans.
You were also very happy with the secondhand smoke indicators.
Yes, we were. On one hand, we are very encouraged that since the early 90s, the measurements of serum cotinine, which reflects exposure to tobacco smoke, have dropped 68% in children, 75% in adults. However, we're still very concerned that levels in children remain twice those of adults, and levels in non-Hispanic blacks are twice those of non-Hispanic whites and Mexican Americans. So we have some focus areas to pay attention to in the future, but large amount of success from efforts in the 1990s in environmental tobacco smoke.
On the other hand, you found trace elements of lots of chemicals that are not so encouraging. What do you see there?
Well, kind of, I think one of the ones we want to pay particular attention to is exposure to mercury. And we want to really watch to make sure women of childbearing age, that's 16 to 49 years, make sure that they don't have mercury levels that might cause neurodevelopmental problems in the developing fetus. And that level has generally been associated with about 58 parts per billion. Now, we didn't find any women in the survey of childbearing age that had levels that high, but we did find 5.7% of women of childbearing age that had levels within a factor of 10 of that 58 part per billion. So the message here is that if you're 16 to 49, be careful about your fish consumption. It's fine to eat fish, but you shouldn't eat fish more than twice a week, and stay away from fish that are big fish that eat other fish, like shark and king mackerel and tilefish.
What about other chemicals you found in the American bloodstream that have caught your attention?
Another one was cadmium. Recent research has shown that cadmium levels at about 1 microgram per gram of creatinine in the urine are associated with early kidney damage and also with bone mineral loss. And we found that 5% of the adult population, people 20 and older, had levels that were at this 1 or higher. And it turns out that the overwhelming dominant factor causing these higher cadmium levels is cigarette smoking. So here is yet another reason that people should stop smoking.
Your director there, Julie Gerberding, described the results of the survey of the American bloodstream as great news, but it's kind of a checkered picture as you describe it.
Well, they're great news on some fronts. Overall, we want to certainly acknowledge progress that we've made in reducing exposures, but there's some places that we want to be careful to watch. Again, we're trying to protect the health of the people. We don't want something to happen like happened in the early 1900s where we added lead to gasoline and we found out much later that it dramatically increased lead levels in people. So this survey is something I think that the American public can be heartened about, that the government is really taking a serious, ongoing look. We'll present reports every 2 years, and we're certainly taking a look at what we think are the priority chemicals so that we can spot anything before it rises too high where we need to take public health action.
We've seen on the front page of the Wall Street Journal this week concerns raised about very common industrial chemicals, that there may in fact be no safe level of some of these. Is it the CDC's job to track this down? I mean, rectifying these, if it's decided that's necessary, would mean real upheaval in the economy. Is it your job to go after that kind of thing anyway?
We certainly at CDC are going after broad areas of chemicals that people have had concern about in terms of determining whether there is a safe level for human exposure and what levels actually do cause adverse effects. We have a broad research program where we're looking at chemicals such as phthalates, bisphenol A, a whole number of pesticides, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, dioxins and dioxin-like compounds. And we are doing exposure and health effects studies at CDC to help really advance this area. But it is certainly something that CDC has put a major priority on. And in the future, I think you'll see results coming from some of our studies based on these biomonitoring measurements, which should help clarify the potential toxicity of these substances.
You're there to protect the public. That's us. What's your message about the general condition of the American environment reflected in our blood? Should we be generally satisfied with it, or should Americans be on a tear to more radically clean up the environment to stay healthy?
I think that the message that we would like to say from CDC is we need to bring the best scientific information to bear for each problem. Sometimes, after a lot of investigation, we find things aren't as bad as we thought they might be. And sometimes we find it's not as good as we thought it was. And so we don't like to put out something just in general that says yay or nay. We basically want to keep a strong scientific approach, being aggressive to look at each individual situation and take the appropriate action.
Well, that's a lot to be on top of. Please be vigilant. And thank you, Dr. Perkle.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Dr. James Perkle is Deputy Director of Science at the Center for Disease Control's Environmental Health Lab. He spoke with me from Atlanta. We are talking tonight about the body chemistry of America, about new insights into the good, the bad, and the toxic in the environment and in your bloodstream. You can join the conversation. Do you feel essentially safe in our chemical environment or menaced by that environment? And what's driving the steady rise in breast and prostate cancers, in autism, in learning disabilities? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Peter Waldman, investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's digging deep into these issues in an ongoing series called Toxic Traces, New Questions About Old Chemicals. The first installment, Common Industrial Chemicals in Tiny Doses, Raise Health Issue, was in Monday's Journal. Peter Waldman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So you're talking, Peter, here about a new perspective on very tiny traces of these chemicals that, as you describe it, is rattling the foundation of environmental law. Why? What do you mean by that?
Well, the new questions have actually been raised now for, the past 7 or 8 years. And by rattling the foundations of environmental law, we simply mean that environmental law is based on proposition that scientists have tested a given substance, usually in laboratory animals, and found the lowest effect or preferably the level where there was no effect of the substance on the animal, and then added in a safety factor of anywhere between 10 to 1,000, meaning they divided that no effect level by 10 or 1,000 and said, okay, that's the level that's safe for people. And when you encounter chemicals, as they have increasingly in the past few years, which they can't really find a no effect level, particularly with the very sophisticated methods that they're looking in animals of various sorts, whether they're laboratory animals or rodents or other kinds of animals. So
meaning no matter how small the trace, there's still an effect.
Exactly. It goes very, very low, and it usually involves a hormonal effect because that seems to be the most sensitive of all at this point that they found. So there's a hormonal effect, let's say, on gene expression from a given chemical in a rat, and that's alarming, and it, as I said, it undermines how we have based these regulations in the past.
Peter, what kind of chemicals in what kind of everyday products that Americans are exposed to?
Well, let's focus for a moment on what we call the endocrine disruptors, the chemicals that are said to have hormonally active properties. And they range. There's some very well-known ones, including dioxin and PCBs, but there are many less well-known ones that are very common still and may indeed not be harmful to people, because let's not overstate the case here.
Mm-hmm.
There is very little direct evidence that these chemicals are harmful to people, but you ask what products and what chemicals. Well, plastics of various sorts, whether it's polycarbonate plastic that they make most baby bottles from. They also make certain water bottles, the hard varieties that are tend to be in offices or that bikers may use for bicycling. Those polycarbonate bottles have something called bisphenol A or BPA, which has been found in very, very low levels to have effects on animals. And they're starting to look very carefully as to whether that could carry over to people.
Peter, stand by, please. We're talking tonight about the body chemistry of America. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Did you hear the good news about much lower levels of lead and secondhand smoke chemicals in the American bloodstream? Did you read the fine print about all the other chemicals out there in you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the body chemistry of America, about new insights into the good, the bad, and the toxic in the environment and in you, your bloodstream, very likely. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Do you feel essentially safe in our chemical environment? And what's driving the steady rise in breast and prostate cancer, in autism, in learning disabilities? What if tiny amounts of the most common industrial chemicals are hurting us and our children? What's to be done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined in this hour by Peter Waldman, investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's in the midst of producing a big series on the new insights that are opening up into our chemical environment. And Peter, you began to walk us through some of the places that scientists are looking most closely. You began with this bisphenol A in, as you say, plastic baby bottles, hard plastic water bottles, and so on. You say it's linked to altered brain structure, neurochemistry, behavior, reproduction, immune response. That's a pretty broad range.
Oh, yeah, but you forgot the last two words that are very, very important. In rodents.
In rodents,
all of those,
yes.
In rodents. All of those things you just described have been found experimentally in rodents, and they are alarming. You know, scientists certainly have a long history of finding things in laboratory animals that then create that then they're able to discover are creating problems in people. But that is not the case thus far with bisphenol A, and I think that's an important distinction. Bisphenol A is only one of many chemicals that are suspected to wreak havoc with the endocrine system, with the hormone system. It turns out that people and animals, and this is where the overlap arises, and there is a lot of concern, people and animals secrete infinitesimal levels of hormones, particularly during development, which tell the body what to do, where to grow, what genes to express, what organs to develop, and particularly with the organs such as the brain, it's very sensitive.
And as you say, what people are looking for are links to these very subtle things, to learning disabilities, potentially to autism. We should take us on down through this menu a little bit. You talk about a chemical that's used in toys, building materials, drug capsules, and cosmetics. What is that? What's the concern there?
Well, there's a family of chemicals called phthalates with a very odd spelling. It's spelled P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. Mm-hmm. Pronounced phthalates, only with the TH,
right.
And there are many of them. They have acronyms and funny names, but they are related in chemical terms, and they tend to be used as plasticizers to make polyvinyl chloride products or PVC products malleable or plastic, and they're used in many, many different PVC products, but they're also used in other more esoteric ways in things like fragrances and perfumes and in nail polishes and in a variety of cosmetics to do a variety of things in those products. Mm. And they have also been shown to have endocrine-disrupting properties, again, in animals. There's something called a phthalate syndrome that's been defined by federal scientists as well as those working for industry who have seen a whole range of effects in laboratory rats, beginning with certain odd genitalia formation all the way down through tumors in rats, not necessarily cancerous tumors, but tumors at an older age. So there's a whole syndrome of effects that have been linked to phthalates in laboratory animals.
But if I read you correctly, correct me if I don't here, but you say that the phthalates have been statistically linked to sperm damage in men and genital changes, asthma, and allergies in children. I assume you mean humans.
Yes, there have been epidemiological work done that has looked at patients suffering from various ailments that you described and found higher levels of phthalates. So that's called a statistical link, and it's a clue that there may be something going on there. It's not a causation. It's not proof, so to speak. But there are statistical associations, particularly, I think, in the area of sperm. There's been a lot done in Europe, as well as in this country, I believe, at the Harvard School of Public Health, linking sperm issues to phthalate concentrations. There was also a very important study recently published by a professor in New York State, whose name is Shauna Swan. She found that the babies of moms who had higher levels of phthalates in their blood during pregnancy were born with very, very, very slight variations in measurements in their genitalia. This specific measurement is between the these are male babies, by the way, a possible male abnormality, and the specific measurement is between the phallus and the anus. They measure that. It's supposed to be, or is generally, about double the length in boys than girls, but they found that they associated a shorter anogenital distance in the babies of moms with higher phthalate levels.
You go on to describe some others, perchlorates used in munitions manufacturing, found in water supplies in 35 states, in fruits and vegetables and breast milk, weed killer, atrazine. I guess the common thread here is, and you're putting this on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, these are all very, very widely used. They're kind of fundamental to our industry and consumer products. What does that leave you thinking, Peter, that we're up against here? I mean, as you say, there's a lot more to be investigated. Most of the research has been done in animals. But if links do emerge here, are we in a position as an economy, as a society, to disentangle ourselves from these chemicals?
Well, the chemical industry and the users of chemical products are extremely ingenious, and there's some wonderful scientists who work for many of the big chemical companies. And I think when harm is proven, they will be the first ones to lead the charge in finding safer chemicals. And what we're talking about there is a growing field, something called green chemistry, which will hopefully one day, if indeed these things are harmful, replace these molecules, because really we're talking about molecules, the shapes of the very smallest bits in our consumer products, you know, the elements of our consumer products. We're talking about changing the shape, changing the characteristics of the molecules that make that stuff up. And we have very sophisticated techniques now to begin to do that. And indeed, there are many efforts to replace bisphenol A. As we, as I mentioned, there are, I believe Procter & Gamble has removed phthalates from their nail polish. So things are, you know, moving forward where harm is adequately and is adequately shown.
And yet it's such a big world, so many products, so many places these chemicals can show up. Peter Waldman, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Paonia, Colorado, Theo Colburn. She's professor of zoology at the University of Florida, former senior scientist at the World Wildlife Fund. She's been called the Rachel Carson of the 90s for her 1996 book, Our Stolen Future. Theo Colburn, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You've paid a lot of attention to these very, very low-level trace chemicals and their potential impacts. How should Americans feel about the chemical environment that we work and live and breathe in and raise children in today? Is it satisfactory? Is it not?
Well, I personally don't think it is not. I'm a grandmother, and I'm very concerned. Personally, I think we have to educate the public more. There's plenty of room for prevention and avoidance. And we're going to have to think more about those individuals who are going to be reproducing, our youngsters and our young children, as they mature and become childbearing age.
You've written that what we are essentially doing, you've said, is neutering the population. What do you mean by that, Theo Colburn?
Well, let's go back to the wildlife where I discovered this problem. In the field, way back in the mid-60s and 70s, wildlife biologists around the Great Lakes were out in the field looking at large populations. Fortunately, a lot of animals come there to reproduce, birds in particular, and looking at colonial nesting birds, large colonies of birds, also looking at the fish in the Great Lakes, they began to realize that in many instances, the fish and the birds weren't reproducing very well. Many populations of particular species were extirpated in areas of high pollution area. And of those animals that they compared with inland animals that were not as exposed to or carried as many chemicals in their body, they began to see a tremendous difference in the reproductive success. That led to looking more closely at how the animals behaved. They found that the animals, the birds in particular, didn't parent very well. There was a lot of female-female pairing. Oftentimes when they went to a colony to explore, the male birds would fly off together and not come back like they should in a healthy colony. They'd hang around like a bunch of fraternity boys and not do the job they should do in sharing with the raising of the young. Getting into the animals and looking more closely, we had a couple of specialists, thank goodness, here and there. This work was being done not in an organized way, but a little piece here and a little piece there. There were scientists out there who began looking at the gonads in the birds and realized that where there were troubled birds, there was a greater percentage of birds that were growing ovaries with male birds growing ovaries with their testes.
So are you saying that you can make a direct link between that research and the human population? Is this speculation? Where do you come down?
Well, when you start seeing this, you begin to wonder, because at that time we knew these same chemicals were in our bodies, but we had no idea, but we felt this is something that really needed to be looked into. Then what happened was, of course, the scientists took what they saw in the field and went into the laboratory and were able to replicate some of the things they saw in the field. Never quite the same way, never to the same intensity. But in the field, the animals were highly exposed to a lot more chemicals than they are in a controlled system in the lab. That certainly led us to the point where, my goodness, what's going on here? Now let's think about this a minute. You begin thinking about all of these animals that were having trouble reproducing. Most of the problems were in the youngsters. They were not in the adult animals. So and it was in those populations where there were higher concentrations of chemicals. The problems were related to the thyroid. There wasn't a bird or fish that the people looked at around the Great Lakes that didn't have a thyroid problem. And by the way, that problem's going on today. The fish in the Great Lakes have a thyroid problem. The fish weren't able to reproduce. This is a reproductive problem that had something certainly to do with development and reproductive function. But the interesting thing was that there were behavioral problems. There were metabolism problems, which made us begin to think, my goodness, this is what involves the endocrine system. What's going on here? There wasn't cancer in these animals, which we had expected to find when we started looking to see what the conditions were around the Great Lakes. And that's when we got the light bulb came on, when we suddenly realized that the way we had been testing chemicals was using toxicology, high-dose testing on adult animals, looking for cancer, looking for obvious birth defects, looking for skin and eye irritation and mutations, that sort of thing, convulsions. But no chemical had ever been tested for its effect on the developing embryo.
So Theo, what about the products that humans are using today? Which ones are you looking at with a suspicious eye, or more than that? And what health problems that Americans are dealing with today are you prepared to say you can draw a link to?
Well, it's hard to say you can draw a link to. Let's remember, there were disorders. Many, you know, over the years, over the centuries, there have been a certain number of people in the population who exhibited certain disorders. But suddenly, around the 1970s, if you get back into the trend data on human health, you will see suddenly an increase in the numbers of cases of autism, ADHD, childhood diabetes, thyroid problems, rampant. I mean, now we're moving into today, looking at breast cancer, prostate cancer, all endocrine disrupted, all endocrine driven problems. You put that together with the production of the chemical, the use of the chemical, you start looking at the first time people in the human population were exposed to these chemicals. Most of them, it began quite intensely right around the middle of the 1940s after World War II ended, when we switched over to high-tech chemistry and we were going to save the world. That increase in production of chemicals over the years has just never stopped. It's continued and continued, and so have these disorders. We can't stop looking at what's happening in the wildlife. We can't ignore that. We can't ignore what we're finding in the laboratory. That's extremely important. And consequently, you put that together, you look what is happening at the population level, in the human population, just like we looked at what was happening to the populations of animals around the Great Lakes, and you begin to think, maybe we better look into this a lot more.
Theo Colburn, Peter Waldman, if you could stand by for just a moment, I want to get one more voice into our conversation.
Okay.
Calling, or with us tonight, I should say, from College Station, Texas, is Stephen Safe. He's professor of toxicology at Texas A&M University. He's a cancer researcher and does research on endocrine disruptors. Stephen Safe, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. We're trying to make sense of what we're hearing and reading. Theo Colburn has been out there for a while now, beating this drum, but now we're reading it through Peter Waldman's reporting on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that some of the most common industrial chemicals in our environment may pose hazards to a degree that we were not aware of before. How do you look at this kind of research and this kind of reporting, Stephen? Do you think we have a problem in our basic chemical infrastructure?
Well, I've always been skeptical of some of the endocrine disruptor hypotheses, and some of them have proven to be wrong, and some of them haven't been. You know, I've never disputed the animal data, nor the Great Lakes data, and the work that Theo's been doing, but we don't see all of these things in humans. There's some indications, and I think Peter mentioned the phthalate story. Well, even with the phthalate story,
this is
mixed.
The chemical in toys and building materials, yeah. Cosmetics.
And he mentioned the fact that there was some association between phthalates in young men and reproductive problems, and not reproductive problems, but perhaps sperm problems, and that was published a couple years ago.
Yes.
But what's happened a lot with human studies looking at these compounds is that all of a sudden we'll have another study, and one just appeared on phthalates, where urinary phthalates in Swedish men didn't show any correlation with semen problems or things like that.
So what do you take away from that? In the murk there's some murkiness.
Well, I would say that if we don't get consistent results, then I think we have to study these things. And if we don't get consistent results, then we got to get on to other things. And the paper on decreased anogenital distance with phthalates. Now that's really the first paper that's come out showing that effect, which is very analogous to what you see in animals. Now, in my opinion, that's a very, very interesting paper. And hopefully what will happen with that is that it'll be followed up, and I'm sure the CDC people will follow up on it, and we'll see what happens. And I think that kind of human study where we look at certain classes of compounds that possibly are of concern based on animal data, we've got to go and look at them in humans. And that particular study, the Swan study and her coworkers, I think is the way we have to go.
The question that comes to my mind is, if we find out that there's a problem here, is our system prepared to self-correct? Stephen Save, Theo Colburn, Peter Waldman, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the body chemistry of America. Listeners, you can join us. What if tiny amounts of the most common industrial chemicals are hurting us and our children? Are you trying to clean up your personal environment, going to the non-toxic dry cleaner, wearing natural fiber? Can it be done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the body chemistry of America, about new insights into the good, the bad, and the toxic in the environment and in you, your bloodstream. We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. What do you think? Is it possible to opt out of the American chemical environment? Are you comfortable? Are you confident that that environment is safe, that it's as safe as it could should be? 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from College Station, Texas, by Stephen Safe, professor of toxicology at Texas A&M University. From Colorado, by Theo Colburn. She's professor of zoology at the University of Florida. She's been called the Rachel Carson of the 90s for her early work in this area. And from San Francisco, by Peter Waldman, investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal, which has just kicked off a front-page series on this issue of common chemicals and their potential effects on humans. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. Gabe is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Gabe. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Gabe?
Well, I just had an observation. This is a really interesting topic. I work in the construction industry, and I see how houses are made nowadays, and it's there's nothing natural about it. I mean, they're all made out of vinyl, plastic, carbon fiber. I mean, everything but anything natural, and even the wood is soaked in chemicals, so it doesn't rot. So,
and these are the houses we live in.
These are actually the most modern houses, and you figure people living in these things at least maybe 10 hours of their life during a day, maybe, and they're just constantly breathing all this stuff in. And even today, when I was getting some water for myself, I got a plastic bottle, and I sat there, and I'm like, gee, I wonder how much of this plastic has leached into my water and that I'm consuming. And just some observations. And of course, you wonder about the long-term effects, and it's sad that we have to just kind of sit and wait and see what happens.
Well, that's the thing, Gabe. They're great observations. You're right in the middle of building houses that we'll all live in. I wonder, are you confident that the American economy, the American system here, is self-correcting? If there are problems, are you confident that they are or will be addressed?
Yeah, probably. Something terrible will have to happen. Something will have to come, where some sort of cancer or something terrible will have to come up, and then of course it'll correct itself. But sad, it's very sad that it has to come to that point, and then the right things will occur. But
yeah,
I guess that's just the way it is.
If indeed it has to come to that point. Gabe, thanks very much for calling in. Peter Waldman, wish you could give us a little response here to what you've heard from Theo Colburn and Stephen Safe, and now from our caller, Gabe. I mean, you've put this on the front burner in your newspaper again. Americans live with this every day. We're surrounded by so many conveniences in the plastics and chemicals that we use, right down to the vaccines that keep us healthy at one level at least. It's hard for people to know how to respond to these reports like yours, like what we're hearing from Theo Colburn, how to integrate that into their sense of well-being, of safeness.
Yeah, it is daunting. There's no question about it. Life expectancies in the United States continue to be quite long relative to other places and other eras. Something to remember.
Though not as long as some of our other developed nations like Japan, which has put down a bunch of new safeguards against some of these chemicals that we're using.
Well, other countries are reacting differently. I would say that, you know, one can take measures in one's life. Certainly, look at the growth of organic agriculture. It's really quite stunning how prominent it is right now in supermarkets throughout the country, not just in the cosmopolitan centers. So people are attuned to these issues. You're right, though. We have a lot of PVC. We have a lot of polycarbonate plastic. And if those substances are proved to be cause of some harm, then I think it will be up to the ingenuity of our culture, of our scientific culture, to replace them.
It's ingenuity. It's also willingness and their economic interests here. Theo Colburn, you've been watching this for a long time. What is your level of confidence, of faith in our government and economic system to self-correct if indeed we have problems?
Well, presently, I don't think our government is that concerned about endocrine disruption. Maybe the scientists and the people working within the government are, but from the top down, the message is this is trivial. But what I've done, I've put together a list. And if anybody wants to get online and contact TEDx at TDS.net, we've put together a list of websites you can get into where you can look into personal care products. A lot of work is being done on that. Household cleaners and pesticides. Building materials, Gabe, you'll be interested in that one. And health care.
Theo, give us that web address once more, please.
Okay, it's TEDx at TDS, that's like Tom, Dick, Sam, TDS.net.
Okay. Got it. And you can find some very practical answers there. Stephen Safe, there's a note of skepticism from another angle, skepticism that the government will do enough. Peters reported that in the last 2 years, the Bush administration has proposed cutting budgets, funding for EPA research on endocrine disruptors. When you look at the research at what we know and what we don't, what's your biggest concern here, the straight safety issues or that it would be disruptive to the American economy to try and replace these chemicals, that we may not have replacements at all?
Well, I agree with Peter that if need be, replacements can be made and can be used. And I think that, the executive branch of the government may not be enthusiastic about environmental affairs. I think we heard at the top of your program some data from CDC. Now, I don't know if Theo had much to do with this, but this is the kind of thing we need, where the whole American population is being surveyed. We're looking for good things and for bad things. And they're in a position now to really go about and find out what's causing something or what's associated with something and what's not. So I think at least from the practical scientific point of view, the type of thing that the CDC is doing is going to be really valuable for us to be able to pick apart about what we need to be concerned about and what we don't need to be concerned about. So, you know, from that point of view, I'm optimistic.
Peter Waldman, you know, there's a lot of concern out there. You know, in your own work about autism and learning disabilities, which seem to have become so widespread. What routes are people following down there as potential causes in the chemical environment?
Well, as I was mentioning before, endocrine disruption, the disruption of the normal hormonal action in a developing fetus, can have grave repercussions for brain development. It was shown, you know, as bisphenol A has been shown to affect the development of rodent brains. Perchlorate. A chemical that's very hotly contested at the moment.
This is the one used in munitions. Bisphenol A is the one used in plastic bottles, in the lining of food cans. But perchlorate, you're saying?
Yeah, well, perchlorate is a military constituent that was used extremely widely in solid rocket fuel throughout the Cold War and essentially just dumped in the ground to seep into water supplies. There's a huge problem in the Las Vegas area where it got into the Colorado River, so they're drinking anywhere from 3 to 6 parts per billion perchlorate in the water from the Colorado River all throughout the southwest of the United States. and higher levels in Las Vegas itself. So perchlorate is a very prominent chemical in the water supply. Perchlorate was found in laboratory rats to cause structural problems in the brain as well as behavioral issues. Mm. Now, the National Academy of Sciences has reviewed the perchlorate science and for its own reasons has chosen not to rely on the rat data for its recommended safe dose. But those findings are there, and the Environmental Protection Agency, some staff scientists, did a huge amount of work analyzing them. They're extremely important findings, and the staff level of the EPA recommended a very strict reference dose or safe level for perchlorate as a result of that. Now, that has been changed since then by the National Academy of Sciences and the upper echelons of the EPA, which has adopted a much higher reference dose or safe limit, but the staff paper and the work on perchlorate in rodents is very important in that regard.
Theo Coburn, let me put the same question to you. Are Americans right to wonder if there's a connection between learning disabilities and what's going on in the environment and why this kind of pressure not to implement the stricter guidelines that they got there, let's say, lower down in the government command chain?
I can't figure it out except for one reason, that so many of the committees that work within EPA are also represented by people from industry who have special interests. You look at the organophosphate pesticides. They're using a crude endpoint, which is basically cholinesterase inhibition. I hate to say that term to the general public, but it shuts down the breaking down of the nerve signals so that nerve signals keep going on and on and on. Mm. Work for 15 years coming out of Duke University has shown that extremely low doses of this chemical, and basically the chemical is called Durspan or chlorpyrifos.
And where is it found?
It's a pesticide that's used
mm-hmm.
widely.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, EPA did take it out of products that are used in the home.
But is this likely to be on people's lawns if they?
Yes, and sprayed in large quantities over agricultural fields yet. But they got in and they realized that it was the chlorpyrifos itself, not its breakdown product, that causes the nerve damage. This basically gets in and changes how the brain develops, interferes with those hormones of the brain, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, how the brain develops.
So what's been done with this insight?
Low dose. Mm. Very early in life may not show up until that individual reaches adulthood, but this is all, of course, again, rat work, but it's at very much lower doses, and this is being ignored, and this product is going through review right now and is going to go through review. EPA has decided to use the old standard.
Give us the product name once more, Theo.
Durspan chlorpyrifos, it's mixed into a lot of products. You'll mm-hmm. find a number of formulations of it on the market.
I want to turn to our callers. Ken is calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
We're well. What do you think, Ken?
Well, I wanted to make a point and ask a question. For 6 years, I was working at Navy headquarters dealing with the practical side of environmental regulation, how to make the ships comply with environmental regulation.
Yes.
And one of the things I found was that much of the environmental regulation, especially levels of contaminants, was more based on emotion and than science.
What do you mean by that? How would you spot that emotion rather than science being behind the restrictions?
Well, the example that's most glaring was dealing with PCBs. In California, to dispose of waste oil, for instance, when a ship's going into a shipyard for overhaul, the Navy at the time was selling the waste oil. It's basically good fuel oil, but it's just left in the tank
yep.
when the ship comes in the shipyard. Well, to dispose of it in California, we had to prove that it contained no PCBs, and every year the level of PCBs that was allowed or that you had to prove were not present was reduced until when I left the job, the level was at 5 parts per billion. Well, you can't detect 5 parts per billion of PCBs in oil because the methods that you use, the oil molecules mask the PCB molecules.
So you're afraid that this kind of fear can be taken to a level that doesn't make sense anymore, but you look around at society like we do. Is there part of you that thinks, gosh, I wonder if there are health effects that are occurring here, even at very low levels, that we ought to care about, or you think it's just emotionally driven?
Well, no, I think we should care about it, but I think we should put the money into the science to determine what those levels are before we jump forward and make regulations that that don't make sense.
Ken, we've got it. Stephen Safe, it sounds like Ken is singing your song a little bit here.
Maybe. Not many people do, but that's good to hear.
Steve, does he know his chemistry? Steve is an expert in PCB analysis.
Yeah, well, Steve, you've noted, Steve, that they spent we spent something like $100 million on research on PCBs and have not found a once suspected link to breast cancer.
That's right. That's
right. I mean, I think the PCB correlations, but the initial correlation showed in a couple small groups increased levels of PCBs in one of the groups in the breast cancer patients versus controls, and I guess 8 or 10 years down the line after 20 or 25 studies, we find that the correlation in larger populations doesn't exist.
Let me get one more call here, if I may.
Yeah, but it's the brain development. It's the PCB's development on the brain that everyone is concerned about.
And its effect on how we live, I guess. Mike is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air, my friend.
Hi, thanks. Question I have is we're living longer than we ever were living before. I mean, the Social Security Trust Fund wouldn't be an issue if we were living a short time span as we were 30, 40 years ago. But yet, everyone's saying, you know, everything around us is killing us.
So we're living longer. What's the problem?
It just seems like another media attempt to make its public paranoid about things we shouldn't be paranoid about.
Yeah, I understand the question. Theo, what do you say to that?
I'll say, first of all, you may be living longer. I don't know how old you are, but as you start looking at the generations that are following us, follow their mortality rates already. Look at what's happening to our children.
Is life expectancy actually shrinking?
We will see in a few years. This is what we're going to have to wait and see. We're keeping people alive because we have such wonderful medical care to keep us alive. You know.
But there could be a kind of trade-off there. We're staying alive, but it's maybe costing more because of other reasons.
Costing more, yes, you bet it is. And it would be very interesting to really begin to see what happens. Look at our children. Look at the number of children in the classrooms. 15% of the boys in classrooms, 5% of the girls have ADHD. Look at one now. In about 150 children born just came out, have some kind of an autistic element. They've got the autistic syndrome worked out so that there are certain characteristics you see, and there's ranges of intensity of autism. But we're seeing that in children. Childhood diabetes.
And that list goes on. We've just got a short time here, if I may. Stephen Safe, we've just got half a minute left. What do you think? Is the conversation too revved up, not revved up enough, or is the concern level about right? How do you read it?
I think we need all sorts of attitudes, and you know, I may have one attitude, but it may not be the right one. And I think we need to have everybody weigh in, and hopefully, in the end, the right course will be taken. I think we need all sorts of opinions.
We'll pray for that. Peter Waldman, here you are publishing this on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. What kind of feedback are you getting from the American business community? Is this welcome news or unwelcome? Does it mean they may have to remake the way they make everything?
Well, I've gotten several emails and telephone calls from various business groups all asking, what are my next stories about?
Please not us.
I think that, listen, I'm not the first person to bring this message. I may be bringing it a bit louder in a forum that hasn't had much of it in the past, but they know that these are serious concerns. They address them. They have PR people and scientists who are looking at it. So I give their scientists various levels of confidence. They range all over the map, and perhaps you'll be reading about some of them in upcoming stories.
I'm sure we will, and a lot of listeners paying close attention tonight. Peter Waldman at the Wall Street Journal, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Stephen Safe at Texas A&M. Stephen, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks. Good to be there.
And Theo Colburn, professor of zoology at the University of Florida. Theo, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me aboard.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.